Good morning. Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Flory, Chief Judge Clary, Judge Connolly, the Honorable James B. Flory presiding.
And please be seated, everyone. And welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I just have a couple of comments before we get started here. Of course, cell phones or any recording devices are not allowed. We'll be posting these oral arguments on the Judicial Branch website within 24 hours and probably later today, so they will be available for public view at that time. And of course, this is a court of law with rules of decorum, so I'd ask that we all be respectful of that process. With that, we'll call the first case on the calendar for oral argument today, in re the applications of Enbridge Energy, court files A18, 1283, 1291, and 1292. I thank the parties for coordinating ahead of time in terms of the splitting of your arguments here. I am understanding that Mr. Strand for Friends of the Headwaters will be addressing the court for 9 minutes, Mr. Zoll for 6 minutes on behalf of the Mille Lacs, White Earth, and Red Lake bands, and that Ms. Crum for respondents will be using 8 minutes, and Mr. Boyd will be using 7 minutes of the oral argument time. Council here, I'm sure, is very familiar with our process, and so please identify yourselves for us when you begin your arguments and adjust the podium to your comfort, and appellants, when you're ready to proceed, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Scott Strand. I'm with the Environmental Law and Policy Center, and I'm here on behalf of Friends of the Headwaters. With me at council table is David Zoll from the Lockridge Grindall firm, who represents the tribes. Paul Blackburn is also here with us, who represents the Honor the Earth organization. If there are any specific questions that need to be addressed specifically to their part of the argument. Members of the court, this is an important appeal. Not just because it's about the controversial Line 3 project, but because it's really one of the first opportunities this court has had to dig into what the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act requires environmental impact statements to include. Most of this court's previous MEPA cases have involved the threshold question of whether an EIS, environmental impact statement, is required. But this case, that question's already been answered. The EIS has already been prepared. And so the question of what has to be included before an EIS can properly be deemed adequate is the question before the court. You know, is it sufficient to facilitate the goals of informed agency decision-making and informed public participation? It is our position that this EIS does not meet that test for two basic reasons. The first is that it becomes critical elements necessary to an analysis of the potential environmental impacts are simply missing. And second, because reasonable alternatives that would be likely to have fewer adverse environmental impacts were either ignored or were dismissed summarily for improper reasons. Now, before I address those two points, I want to just comment briefly on the standard of review and the question of deference to agency decisions. All parties have dutifully quoted you the provisions of the Administrative Procedures Act and the elements of what arbitrary and capricious means, but there is a dispute over the level of deference that the agency is owed. And if when you look at the respondents' briefs, the argument is that, as it's put in, I think, the PUC's brief, all agency determinations on environmental review matters are entitled to substantial deference. We submit that that's not correct. Issues of statutory construction are for this court to determine de novo. We're not going to delegate to each of the dozens of state agencies or hundreds of local units of government who can be responsible for preparing an EIS to make their own determinations about what adequate means. The courts have also...
Let me just ask you about that, Mr. Strand. I understand the argument that you just made, but before you folks got here, I mean, this has been, this environmental impact process has been going on for, you know, a couple of years. You know, there's 100,000 pages of record. How is it that we don't give some deference to what happened before the matter got here and the decisions that were made?
Well, Your Honor, all decisions below are entitled to a presumption of correctness. But where deference is owed, where the thumb really is on the scale, is when you're deferring to agency findings of fact that are within the scope of their technical expertise. And we don't deny that that's something where deference is appropriate. But where we do question the level of deference is when it comes to the basic statutory standard of adequacy. What's required in an environmental impact statement to meet that statutory standard? That's a legal determination that this court has to make. So let me turn to the two elements that I think are missing in this environmental impact statement. First, the elements that are missing from the assessment of potential adverse environmental impact. There are a couple of things that are in the briefs that are pretty easy to understand. Tribal cultural resources. EIS acknowledges that there are tribal cultural resources within this route, that they need to be evaluated, and that they just simply didn't do it. Their claim is that it's acceptable to simply defer that process to some later part of the process. What that does, of course, is take the public out of its opportunity to comment on what the impacts might be. So the tribal cultural resources are missing. Mr. Zoll will address that in greater detail. Number two, the St. Louis River Estuary, Duluth Superior Harbor, Lake Superior, the elephant in the room, an iconic water resource for the state of Minnesota, a pipeline proposed to run right next to it, and it doesn't appear in the EIS.
So, you know, I thought I saw that the final scoping document indicated that the EIS was to consider the potential effects on the Lake Superior watershed. And so where is it lacking in that regard from your point of view so as to render this inadequate?
Well, there are a couple of elements, Your Honor. I mean, I think you can tell from reading through the EIS that any discussion of Lake Superior is extremely limited. We're asked to project from the representative river crossing sites that they did go into deeper analysis on and project from there what the impact might be on Lake Superior. We don't know the quantity of oil that could reach the lake if there was a catastrophic breach of the pipeline. And we don't know what the impact of that would be on the natural resources in the lake.
It be really bad?
It would be bad, Your Honor.
So assuming we all know that, you know, they're suggesting, well, we did all these models and here they are, but you're suggesting they should have done a specific analysis for Lake Superior.
I am, Your Honor,
okay.
Simply because it is such an important water resource and the potential significant impact could be obviously very, very severe.
Counsel, it's more than just Lake Superior, though, right? You're talking about the St. Louis River, you're talking about the harbor.
Yes, absolutely, okay. Your Honor. Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think it sort of illustrates, I think, a problem we have even with all of the representative sites that the EIS does analyze is that what we're essentially left with, I mean, there is modeling that was done, fate and transport modeling, they call it. How far would the oil go if there was a breach? And then we get some generic discussions about what oil does to things, what oil can do to fish, what oil can do to birds, what it can do to wildlife, what it can do to drinking water. What we don't have is an assessment of what that specific impact would be on those natural resources. To follow up on Judge Connolly's question, one of the things that where the cases, and this is mostly federal cases, but where the cases are really clear, is that simply saying the impact would be significant isn't enough. Part of the
what
response.
What if they said it would be catastrophic? Would that be enough?
No, it would not be enough, because what we need, Your Honor, in an EIS, and I think this is a matter of law, is we need an assessment of the significance and the magnitude of the impact.
But the respondents argue in their briefs that that's not possible because there's so many factors that could come into play on that in terms of time of the year, water levels, flow rates, the weather even at the time, the size of the spill, and that if you factor in all of those, what they argue is that, you know, it's impossible to model every possible eventuality. So where does it fall short?
it is impossible to model every potential, circumstance that could arise. But that's, and we're not suggesting that that's what the EIS requires, but we are suggesting that what EISs need to do is assess the actual impact on the resources. You know, an analogy would be in a typical case where there's a question about air pollution. You might get a model that says, here's how far the air pollution would travel. But if you don't get an assessment of what the health impact of that movement of air pollution would be, you haven't met your requirements under the EIS. We submit that that's the same thing that's happening here. We know how far the oil might travel, but we don't know in any of those particular places what that impact might be.
Counsel, isn't part of your argument as well that, that there's very little on mitigation measures?
That is part of the argument in terms of mitigation measures. The discussion in the EIS, I think, is appropriately focused on alternatives. Are there ways to fulfill the purpose and need of this particular pipeline without running a pipe along this particular route? And so the alternatives kind of become the mitigation. Obviously, as you can tell from our briefs, we have a concern that alternatives were dismissed too quickly, or they were completely ignored. Expanding current capacity of the pipelines, using pipeline facilities that are not Enbridge facilities. I think as a matter of law, it's a mistake to limit the range of alternatives to only things that the particular project proponent would benefit from. So we lose the discussion of alternatives that we need in order to make that kind of reasoned decision-making at the agency, and most important, I think, Your Honors, at the public level. So I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Zoll, but again, we request that the decision of the PUC to hold this adequate be vacated, be remanded to the commission to fill in the gaps in this environmental impact statement, and that further proceedings in this be enjoined until that task is completed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Strand. Mr. Zoll, you may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court. I'm David Zoll of the law firm Lockridge Grindle Nowen, and I'm arguing today on behalf of the tribal relators. The revised FEIS for the Line 3 project is inadequate as a matter of law for at least two reasons. First, the FEIS entirely failed to analyze the potential impacts to tribal cultural resources along the proposed route and each of the alternatives, notwithstanding a commitment to do so as stated in the scoping document. Second, the FEIS failed to distinguish between the relative impacts of constructing and operating a pipeline in a new corridor rather than adjacent to existing pipelines.
It's that latter issue that I'm particularly interested in, Mr. Zoll, because obviously this pipeline takes a turn to the right and heads south in Clearbrook and skirts around the Leech Lake Indian Reservation and then heads east toward Lake Superior and into a new pipeline corridor. And, it never really was explained to me why that route was chosen, although with the suggestion that the leases or the easements across Leech Lake Reservation run out in 9 or 10 years, that might indicate why there's a need to go around that. But it was a concern of mine as to whether or not the state environmental impact statement fully considered the impact of opening up a new pipeline corridor. So that's the issue I'm particularly interested in.
Thank you, Your Honor, and it doesn't. And I'll explain why it doesn't fully analyze the impacts of opening up a new pipeline corridor. And it's most easily distilled to the fact that it doesn't distinguish between impacts along a new corridor versus an existing corridor. I think everybody can understand that if you're running a pipeline where existing pipelines are, a lot of those impacts have already been incurred, or the risk is already there. There's if you stay in the mainline corridor where there are five other pipelines, there's a risk of spill throughout that entire corridor. Adding another pipeline or replacing it changes the incremental level of that risk, but it doesn't introduce an entirely new risk. If you put in a new corridor, you're introducing a new risk to the environment and the resources in that corridor that did not previously exist. And the EIS doesn't clearly distinguish between the resources that would be impacted along a new versus an existing corridor. If you look at the FEIS, for each of the route alternatives, you can't see whether the number of acres of forest land that would be impacted already have a pipeline or not. That's simply missing. And I'm not just saying that. The commission in December 2017 directed the Department of Commerce to revise the FEIS to clearly identify the extent to which resource impacts of the route alternatives in the existing Line 3 corridor are or are not additive. That simply was not done. The boilerplate additions that were made in the revised FEIS don't identify whether the potentially affected resources are adjacent to an existing pipeline or whether they're in a new corridor. There's no substantive change to the analysis in chapters 5 and 6 of the FEIS, just changed circumstances, the passage of time. And that urgency to make a decision on the project doesn't justify the commission essentially reversing its own decision and saying information that was crucial to an adequate EIS in December 2017 was no longer needed in May of 2018. I want to focus, if I may, on the cultural resource issue, because I think here the failing is even more clear. The final scoping decision document, which identifies the alternatives and impacts that will be considered, specifically stated that potential impacts to cultural resources can occur and will therefore be evaluated across the applicant's preferred route and the alternatives. That was not done. The FEIS says so clearly and unambiguously twice in Chapter 5 of the FEIS. To date, no specific studies of traditional cultural properties have been completed within the region of interest. And it says that while acknowledging that information gathered from consultation with the tribes indicates that these resources are there. It's clear and obvious on the face of the FEIS that it didn't address this crucial issue that was addressed in the scoping document that they said they were going to analyze, and for that reason, it clearly fails the first test of adequacy under 4410-2800 subpart 4 that it addresses the issues raised in scoping.
Council, would you agree then that what it appears is that the commission was satisfied that, there be a survey done before the start of construction?
That appears to be the commission's position. That's what they required in their December 2017 order.
And your co-counsel would suggest that that takes it out of the public comment period. Do you agree?
That it takes it out of the public comment? Correct. And let me address precisely why that's not adequate to say that they'll have the Army Corps survey completed. Choosing to defer to the Army Corps process doesn't absolve the commission of its obligation to analyze these issues in detail. And what they are essentially saying is, we'll rely on construction mitigation in order to handle this. And I think this court's decision in the Trout Unlimited case is particularly instructive, where the court clearly said you can't rely on mitigation to avoid analyzing issues in an EIS. The EIS has to come first. You have to study the issues. You have to look at the alternatives to make an informed decision between whether to go forward with a proposed project, the various alternatives, or what mitigation might be required. And that first step is plainly missing, and we request that this matter be remanded to the commission to complete that missing analysis.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Saul. You will, appellants will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. I don't know if you're going to want to split that. You can quietly talk about that and see what you come up with. All right. Thank you. Counsel for respondent, Ms. Crum.
May it please the court. My name is Lisa Crum. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. The issue before the court today is whether the commission properly determined the Line 3 FEIS as adequate under MEPA. The answer to this question is yes, and the commission's adequacy order is entitled to deference by this court. Relators disagree with the decision made by the commission, but the commission, as the responsible governmental unit with the obligation and the technical expertise to determine adequacy, fully considered all of the arguments and evidence put on by relators.
Counsel, what does it mean to be an assisting agency? I mean, the DOC, the ERA, was selected by your client, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And they had a memorandum of understanding with the DNR and the MPCA.
That's correct.
And then when the MPCA and DNR expressed reservations about whether the revisions were sufficient to fulfill the commission's directive in requiring supplementation, your client decided not to honor those concerns?
Your Honor, the commission did consider the information provided by the agencies. And in fact, the commission was obligated by statute to have the Department of Commerce prepare the EIS in this case under 216E03. And the commission saw that it was very important that the sister agencies contribute to that. So clearly the MOU was entered for purposes of that collaboration. Now, the agencies could also submit comments as well, which is what they did. And the commission fully considered those comments and, in fact, fully vetted out questions at commission hearings regarding those comments. So those were considered in the record.
Ms. Crum, could you address the issue that concerns relators relating to, you didn't do a specific analysis for the estuary, Duluth, and Lake Superior. And why, if you didn't, is that not fatal to this impact statement?
Your Honor, the commission, the FEIS in this case, included two very important reports along with much more evidence in the FEIS. But those two reports were prepared by an interagency team. And that team consisted of the Department of Commerce, the Department of Natural Resources, PCA, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And that interagency team determined the representative samples that were appropriate for the considerations in this FEIS. My understanding on why those samples were chosen is because of the diversity of characteristics in evaluating spills and the range of resource types. So based on the interagency team's conclusions and the commission's agreement that what was provided in the EIS was complete and adequate for purposes of the environmental review.
You know, along those same lines, I mean, I think what we're getting to is whether or not by excluding a specific analysis of Lake Superior, the decision of the MPUC was arbitrary. I mean, since I was a little kid, I've been hearing that Lake Superior is the largest freshwater body of water in the world. And so it seems like that's a particularly unique characteristic of the route of the pipeline. There are cases that suggest that failure to follow the final scoping document can render the FEIS inadequate. And here, the final scoping document did require consideration of the potential impact specifically on the Lake Superior watershed. So why isn't that, as Judge Connolly said, fatal to this and requiring a remand to the MPUC to address that specific, unique factor?
Your Honor, the team of experts that reviewed and gathered the information, they are the experts in this area. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the DNR, the PCA, the Department of Commerce, they are the experts in this area. And they found that the information that was provided in the FEIS was representative to the extent that it could apply to those areas. They also found that in the event of a spill, that it was highly unlikely that it would even come close to that area.
Well, counsel, the representative approach arguably does not meet the final scoping decision document's mandate in the sense that the FEIS at 1060 analyzes the impact on the Mississippi River. It could have been done. You could have looked closer at St. Louis, the harbor, and Duluth. Both for possible adverse effects and for mitigation measures if those adverse effects occurred. That wasn't done. Are we supposed to just rely on the experts saying don't worry about it?
Your Honor, the experts determined that the information that was gathered was representative, so that information could apply to spills all over the state of Minnesota.
Well, we get that, and that's certainly been briefed on both sides, but the question is that adequate in this circumstance, this representative approach? And your position is that it is, and your opponents say that it is not.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
So, I mean, so what case would I rely on to say you win on this issue? I mean, our standard review or just deference to the experts? I mean, at any point did the other side up say, hey, you didn't look at Duluth and Superior, and was there a response like, well, don't worry about it, it's going to be in the report? I mean, did any time did the relators say, what about Duluth and Superior? And did anybody say, well, what did anybody say? Well, first of all, did anybody say that? You didn't look at Duluth and Superior while this process was going on.
Your Honor, the record's been fully developed on the positions of the relators, okay. So yes.
So during that process then, what did you say in response, or what did anybody relating to the PUC say in response to their concerns? Like,
well,
you said,
the team of experts determined the best way to analyze and prepare the FEIS with the spill data. And that's what the experts decided. And the commission relied on its experts in making its decision that the FEIS was adequate and that it had the information it needed to proceed with the other dockets that will rely on this information. This specifically, you know, the FEIS is one piece of a much larger proceeding in this case. And yes, I certainly would respond to your question in saying that reserve mining and the other cases that show deference to the commission apply in this case. The department, in coordination with other sister agencies and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, fully evaluated this record. To be clear, over 30 public meetings were held, resulting in over 3,000 public comments. The department responded to these comments and fully complied with the MEPA process. Parties had numerous opportunities to present their own evidence as to why the department had not satisfied its burden under MEPA. But the burden in this challenge is on the relators. The burden is on relators to show, not to show that another decision.
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up here, Ms. Crum. You're over your time, so you can wrap up your argument. I thought you were about to do that, but it seems like you're moving into a different part of your argument here. So if you can wrap up, and we'll go to Ms. Boyd.
Absolutely. Just repeating that the standard here is not if there's another decision that would be supported by the record, but whether the commission's decision was reasonable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Boyd.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thomas Boyd here on behalf of Enbridge Energy. I would like to address the questions about Lake Superior. And, Your Honor, Judge Connolly, you asked, was the question asked during the process? It was. It was specifically asked by Commissioner Lipschultz, and there was a specific back-and-forth dialogue about what had been done. And that can be found in the transcript, the December 7, 2017, hearing transcript, which is Exhibit CNRI 2805 at pages 109 to 112. I'd like to back up and address the context of the question, which is the scoping document. The scoping document indicated that the effect on the Lake Superior watershed should be considered, and it was. That was not a directive to do a specific site modeling study. In fact, The scoping document recognized and endorsed representative modeling instead. This is reflected by the fact that that was specifically discussed and endorsed in the scoping document. And that's exactly what the agencies, plural, did, not only the EERA, but the PCA, the DNR, and the Army Corps of Engineers reviewed the various sites, including the site closest to Lake Superior, which is the Pokegamot River site. And that was, again, discussed in response to Commissioner Lipschultz's questions. And the response was...
Pokegamot River site, that's what, that's got to be 90 miles from Lake Superior. I mean, that's a third of the way across Minnesota from where the pipeline ends. So.
I believe it's closer than that, Your Honor. But it's,
well, I'll certainly defer to Judge Flory on that.
Yeah, I would too. I would too. You have personal knowledge. But in any event, that was considered by these agencies, and staff responded to Commissioner Lipschultz's question very directly, saying that that was looked at. First of all, it wasn't appropriate as a representative site for several reasons, which are identified. Secondly, they used the representative site modeling, specifically the Sandy River site, to determine whether there would be a likely impact from a spill. And the agency's experienced determination was there would not be. And that is information that is drawn from the EIS. Those determinations were subsequently reviewed by the ALJ, who found that the review of those issues was adequate, and that can be found at the findings, pages 34 to 35. And the PUC, in its final approval, expressly addressed the issue and determined that this site, the representative site modeling, was more consistent with what had been raised during the scoping process than doing a site modeling approach. So that was squarely addressed.
Question is whether it was addressed sufficiently.
Yes, and the agency provided testimony in response to the commission's questions, and they were satisfied that it had been done sufficiently, and that's borne out by the record.
Counsel, I had a question that we haven't got to, and that has to do with the cumulative potential effects. And is the capacity, the likely capacity, full flow capacity, 915,000 barrels per day?
That's the potential capacity of the replacement. That is not what is being proposed, and there are no current plans for that.
Right, it's 760. I get that, but shouldn't that be considered as a cumulative potential effect if it's a potential full capacity?
Your Honor, the answer is no. That's something that was squarely considered by the agency. They received information that was put forth suggesting that that was a plan, and they applied the standards from the regulation, which require it has to be a current plan, which it is not, or it has to be a plan for which reasonable expectations have been laid. And there was no evidence in the record sufficient to demonstrate that that was the case. That's important because if it's going to be considered as a cumulative effect, you need sufficient details to determine what is the actual plan. Is it in fact going to go to 915? Would it be something less than that? When would it happen? And there was a recognition by the ALJ and others that depending on what the plan is, that would require some additional review in the future.
Well, it does kind of make the word potential superfluous. I mean, if we're talking about potential, and if the full flow capacity is likely to be 915,000, again, we're back to potential, are we not? I mean, I'm not saying it will be. I don't think they are either. It's 760, right. But
that's exactly why the rule defines cumulative effects and has this criteria to give the agency guidance to evaluate and use its judgment as to whether or not there's enough in the record to determine that it's more than potential, that it's a plan. Okay. Have permits been filed? Have zoning ordinances been modified? Those sorts of things. There's nothing like that in the record. And in fact, Enbridge has been clear that that is not a plan, a current plan.
So on this cumulative effects, it's the same question I had for relators. You've got an established corridor going directly through Leech Lake Reservation, yet when you get to Clearbrook, you're turning south and skirting that area. The argument is that, you know, the FEIS doesn't take into account the cumulative effects of opening up a new pipeline corridor that isn't there now.
In fact, what can you point to that? Certainly. Chapter 12 deals with cumulative effects. Specifically, a new corridor, an additional pipeline, would be addressed at Chapter 12, pages 37 to 39. So that's expressly addressed. That hasn't been ignored. Secondly, or with respect to the first part of your question, the new route follows existing utility corridors. So it's my understanding the thought process is that it would not be opening up new corridors, or at least for that segment, that instead they would be following existing utility lines.
Not oil pipelines, so.
No. Or at least not that it comes to mind. But the thinking is to be as least disruptive as possible. So there was a thought process that was explained and vetted through the course of these proceedings. I have much more to say, but I realize my time is up. I appreciate your time and attention today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd. Rebuttal?
Your Honor, my colleague, Mr. Zola, has requested 1 minute to just address one issue, so I'll take 4 minutes, if Perfect. It's acceptable to the court.
It is.
I want to address, I guess, three issues in this rebuttal. First of all, the question about, you know, why the new corridor? And I think the court referenced the fact that Enbridge has got a land use restriction problem, is that they've got easements with a limited term that are likely going to disappear. They need to move pipelines to another corridor, but at the same time, their purpose and need is to continue to use the Clearbrook and Superior terminals. As you've seen in the briefs, one of the key problems with this EIS is that the definition of the purpose and need of the project is much too narrow and reflects more what Enbridge's purpose and need is and not what the purpose and need of the government action is. There is a lot of evidence in the record that the purpose and need of this project, like all the proposed pipeline projects, is to facilitate the movement of tar sands oil to tidewater so that those producers get better access to global markets. When you look at the issue in that context, there are a lot of alternatives that would do that better in a way that would have less of an adverse impact. But this EIS keeps it very narrow. They reject alternatives because they don't go to Clearbrook. They reject alternatives because they don't go to Superior, even though that has nothing to do with the ultimate purpose and need of this project. None of the oil is going to stop in Superior. It's going to move south through Wisconsin and Illinois to Enbridge terminals there, and then according to the evidence that Enbridge submitted, most of it will end up going to the Gulf Coast. So when you look at the purpose and need appropriately, which the cases make it clear as part of the obligation of the court when it's reviewing it, the range of alternatives becomes much broader. Second point, technical expertise. Throughout the respondent's argument, the response to the questions was, well, look, the agency decided, and the agency met with people from other agencies, and they all decided, and they're the experts, and so that's the end of it. But just look at what we're talking about here. This is the first ever pipeline EIS for the PUC. The technical expertise isn't
Mr.
there.
Mr. Strand, on this very subject, is your argument that the commission didn't consider it at all or simply, is that your argument, that they didn't consider it at all?
Consider the input from the other agencies?
That the commission did not consider the impact on Duluth, Lake Superior, or the headways?
Well, that there's slight language about it in the EIS, but it doesn't make any progress from the scoping. Are we talking about
note 39?
Yes.
I guess what I'm trying to decide is, you know, for purposes of our review, you're saying they didn't consider it at all, and the commission in that footnote is saying, no, we heard what you said. However, we believe that the modeling concerns addressed it, and the commission agrees with the ALG report that the FEIS adequately considered financial resources to remediate spill impacts. So I guess my question is, if that's what they're saying they did, and I'm assuming they're saying, you know, that that's not a lie, what is our power to reverse that? That seems to me, then that's not arbitrary or capricious. They didn't consider it the way you wanted them to consider it, but they did consider it this way, which seems to have support in the record. So why is that wrong that allows us to reverse this decision?
Well, Your Honor, I think the way to look at something like that, I mean, that's a statement that you sometimes see in agency decisions across the board, is that we considered all the factors and we decided this way. But that's not a rationale. That's not an explanation.
It is if they provide an explanation for it. I mean, I don't know whether this role modeling is the way to go versus the way you want it, but that's not the issue. The issue is, under our standard of review, is that arbitrary and capricious?
It is, Your Honor. I mean, one of the factors in arbitrary and capricious, as the court well knows, is that when a decision is so implausible that it can't be explained by the application of agency expertise. To conclude that Lake Superior, Duluth Harbor, the St. Louis Estuary is not something that needs to be considered, even if you're going to deal with all of the river crossings through some kind of a representative analysis, we think is arbitrary and capricious. All right, light's blinking, so unless you have further questions.
Oh, I'm sure we all do, but I'm not going to go there.
All right, thank you.
We'll let Mr. Zoll have the last word.
Thank you. I just briefly want to address the standard of review as it relates to the claims raised by the tribal relators. The decision can be reversed where it's affected by an error of law or where it's arbitrary and capricious. In this case, with respect to the impacts on cultural resources, you have a scoping decision document that says the impacts will be evaluated and an FEIS that acknowledges on its face that those were not fully evaluated. In fact, that no study was done. That is inconsistent with the black letter standard in 4400-2800. And that necessarily is a decision, the decision that the FEIS was adequate, is necessarily affected by an error of law when it's inconsistent with the plain requirements of the regulations. It's also arbitrary and capricious because it entirely failed to consider an important aspect of the problem. The analysis was hardly the hard look required by reserve mining. It was more of a passing glance at these issues. And I commend the court again to the Trout Unlimited case by this court, which, although in a different context, is directly relevant to the question of whether important issues that everyone acknowledges are a concern need to be addressed in an EIS before moving on to the decision about whether to grant a permit or what mitigation is required. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right. Well, I thank all of counsel here for your arguments today and for the extensive briefing in this. I know 15 minutes is woefully inadequate, but that's what the rules allow. But you put in way more than 15 minutes in your written submissions, which we rely on extensively. So I commend you for the way the case was presented to this court. It's an important case. We'll have a decision for you on this issue within the next 90 days. We take it under advisement at this time. Thank you. We're going to take a short recess while we reconfigure the courtroom. And
thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Kyle.
Thanks,
Kyle. Good for you.